morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
I think the question before the court, I think as framed in the briefs, is a simple one. Can this action be maintained through the use of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 59 and 60? Or is the a time frame set forth in Section 1083 also essentially a statute of limitations for the filing or maintaining of any of any claim or case under the NDAA? I think it's very clear from the statutory framework that the time frame for set forth in 1083 is just what it appears to be. The time frame for filing Section 1083 motions under 1083 to maintain, bring or maintain an action under the new statute. It does not amend or modify the rights that a plaintiff may have under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 59 and 60 to seek relief from the court and maintain an action under 1605A through the use of those procedural devices afforded plaintiffs under those two rules of civil procedure. And I think the statutory framework, the fact that...
Can I ask, I'm just a little unclear on what you mean by that. So if the court had granted, I don't know, 60B, your 60B motion, what would it have done?
Well, we were asking the court to allow us to proceed under the 1605A.
Well, doesn't 1605A decide who gets to proceed under 1605A?
Yes, and 1605A sets forth a statute of limitations, and it does not include the time frame set forth in 1083 as far as the filing of 1083 motions. The statute of limitations under 1605A, and it doesn't include the 60-day window period. It sets forth a statute of limitations setting forth a 10-year period for the filing. That's set out
for them. But it refers to, in the case of an action that is refiled under this section by reasons of Section 1083C2A, which contains its own statute of limitations.
Well, I submit that...
The wording is right?
Well,
what I just said.
Well, the 1605A(b), the statute of limitations, it sets forth actually the period of time in which an action to proceed to be brought or maintained to utilize the new statute may be maintained. We meet that limitations.
What is the meaning of the phrase, which is in 1605A? In the case of an action that is refiled under this section by reason of Section 1083C2A?
Well, we are not, I don't believe it has application here because we weren't attempting to refile an action.
But then don't you have to file a motion?
Well, we did file a motion.
Within 60 days? It says only within. A motion may be made or an action may be refiled only if and within the 60-day period. It seems,
right, that motion
seems
may
kind of open and shut, doesn't it, that it had to be within 60 days?
No, I don't believe so. But certainly a motion under 1083 would have had to been brought under that time period. But we're making, essentially, the argument would be that Rule 59 and Rule 60 were by implication deleted from the rights or procedural mechanisms that a plaintiff could utilize. And I don't believe that was Congress's intent.
Why would Congress be so firm about the 60 days if it had in mind a whole slew of circumstances, perhaps virtually all the circumstances where 1083 is applicable, where it wouldn't make any difference?
Well, because it wanted to provide a new procedural avenue for those individuals who couldn't utilize Rule 59 or Rule 60. We were within the time limitations within the what had been procedural rights that a plaintiff could proceed under 1605A, given, obviously, it would have to be through the discretion of the trial court, whether the trial court would allow and grant a motion under 60B and Rule 59, obviously that would be something for the trial court to decide. But that was a right that all plaintiffs would have had prior to the passage of the NDAA. And but what the argument would be in opposition to our argument is that by implication, Congress meant to amend or essentially state that the rights that they would have under Rule 59 or Rule 60.
Do you have any indication that that's what Congress was thinking about, the Rule 59 and 60 issue?
Well, I think the issue really is, I mean, typically, as actually decided in, as the court explained in Simon and Roeder, I think the new cases that the opposition now has, or amicus has now presented to the court, make it really clear that to amend or by implication, it's disfavored to essentially, unless Congress sets forth clearly that it intends to, well, it intends to revoke any privilege or rights that a plaintiff would have had.
This was giving you a new right.
Yes.
But saying to take advantage of it, you had to move promptly, and it's a harsh rule.
I don't read the statute to say that. I mean, because, and I think that's
well,
why
before
they said,
this act, could you get punitive damages?
That's correct.
You could not.
I mean, what I meant to say is, yeah. We could not get punitive damages.
And so this was a new right.
Yes.
But to take advantage of it for cases, there's a section prior actions for cases that had already been filed, you had to move promptly. And for whatever reason, Congress set forth a very specific rule without any apparent exceptions.
Well, we don't read the statute that way. And the reason why we don't is because what you will be setting forth by implication is that if 1083, if the time frame set within 1083, that is the 60-day window, mm-hmm. was part of the statute of limitations of 1605A-B, and if mm-hmm. it was one of the subsections of 1605A-B saying has to be filed within 10 years, and then if you want to maintain an action under this that has been previously filed under the previous statute, you have to file within the 60-day window, I would agree with the court. Mm-hmm. But it's not set forth within the statute of limitations.
So what was the point of the statute of limitations that is in 1083 if it doesn't apply to actions under 1605A?
Well, it applies for those cases in which a motion under 1083 was filed.
So you have a choice. You can either be stuck with the statute of limitations by filing a motion, or you don't have any statute of limitations at all by filing 60 under Rule 59 or Rule 60.
No, you still have the statute of limitations that's set forth in 1605A.
Wouldn't somebody always, in a pending case, in a prior case, always choose the route you're choosing? And if that's the case, why bother with putting a statute of limitations in 1083?
Well, I don't believe that they would, and here's the reason why, is because under 1083, had obviously, in retrospect, if we were aware of the 60-day window, and if we were aware that the courts would construe it to be a 60-day window at the time, we would have filed under a motion under 1083, and we would have had a right to proceed under there. We are in a less advantageous position. We're asking.
Doesn't your construction create an anomaly between cases still in any form in the district court and cases which have moved on to the Court of Appeals? Because your Rule 59, Rule 60 escape hatch would not apply to cases where jurisdiction has moved to the Court of Appeals, but they are covered by 1083.
Well, we meet the time frame within Rule 60. The time frame of both the motions under 59.
I understand that.
60.
I'm talking about your construction of the statute.
But
the statute seems to put radical contract to the contrast to the language of 1083, a gulf between plaintiffs whose cases are in district court and plaintiffs whose cases have moved on to the Court of Appeals.
And they, well, that I ha, well, we're not, when you say at the time the motion is filed, at the time a Rule 59 or Rule 60 motion is filed, in those cases in which somebody would be trying to file a motion for the under the federal rules for which the Court of Appeal already has jurisdiction?
Right.
Well, that's not our case, but
I understand it's not your case, but you're offering us a construction of the statute, which seems to me just rife with anomalies, and I'm addressing the anomaly between cases in district court and cases in the Court of Appeals.
Well, I don't believe it is an anomaly because that same anomaly occurs without the construction. One can only proceed under Rule 59 and 60 if the case is still in the district court.
But you can't if it's moved on to the Court of Appeals, right?
That's correct. Okay. So the point is, I don't believe it's an anomaly today. If
one set of people get the Rule 59-60 set of limits, and the other get the statute.
Well,
with no apparent reason to draw that difference.
Well, I don't believe that we are creating an anomaly because it does not increase the reach of Rule 59. It doesn't increase the Rule 60.
I'm not saying it does. I'm saying it makes the language of 1083 seem kind of random in its application.
Well, I don't believe so because, in fact, 1083 would probably be the preferred method that a plaintiff would utilize if they were aware of the window at the time, during the 60-day period. I don't believe it's a random application because I think the Congress stated, well, we're going to have a special rule. We're really going on the limb here. In addition to your rights that you may have had under Rule 59 and 60, and for those plaintiffs who could not utilize those statutes, those federal rules, we're going to create a new time frame which you could just, from cases that already been decided, to to gain jurisdiction of the court once again, which is an unusual thing. Obviously, that's an unusual thing. And so the Congress set forth for those kind of cases in which you're seeking that unusual relief that 1083 allows you to have, you're going to have to file within that 60-day window to have some kind of predictability. But we are not seeking that unusual relief that the Congress afforded through 1083. We are seeking the application of 1605A, and 1605A has its own statute of limitations set forth, and it doesn't include the 60-day window.
Can I ask you, your 59E motion was based on intervening change, right?
That's correct.
And what was the intervening change of law?
Well, it's set forth in our papers. We believe, I think the what we were stating is that the statute was passed.
The statute was passed in January. The judgment was on July 17th, and your motion was on July 30th. There wasn't any intervening change of law between the judgment and your motion.
There was an intervening change of law between when the court took it under submission.
Well, then you could have made the motion then. You can't wait until after the judgment and then make that argument.
Well, it is true that
that's not what we normally consider an intervening change in law, right?
Well, we also moved under Rule 60B.
I just want to pause. Let's do each one. So there really is no argument under 59E. There was no intervening change of law between the judgment and your motion.
Well, there was an intervening. Well, I believe there was an intervening change of law between the time the case was taken under submission and the.
But you could have, if that were the case. You filed a supplemental memorandum seeking punitive damages on July 6th, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So you could have made any argument then about the NDAA, right?
Well, in that supplemental memorandum, we in fact were.
Well, if you did make the argument, then there's certainly no intervening change of law for 59E. You just disagree with the result. There's nothing intervening.
And I understand it, but the statute had not been construed as of yet, and so obviously the construction was intervening. But I believe I understand Your Honor's point that the statute had been passed.
All right. And your grounds under 60B is the catch-all, right?
Yes.
And that's the one that Supreme Court says only under the most extraordinary circumstances. Why are these the most extraordinary circumstances? That is, it has to fit none of the other elements of Rule 60B and be truly extraordinary.
I do think that the district court should have had the ability to utilize its discretion, and it didn't realize it did, and it said that it did not believe it had discretion to utilize did not have its ability to utilize its discretion under Rule 59 or Rule 60B. We ask this court to remand it to allow the district court to decide whether under those rules it believes that in this case plaintiffs should be able to proceed under the new statute.
Okay, your time's expired. Thank you. We'll hear from the amicus.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. Jessica Amundson, as amicus, and with me at council table is David DeBruin, who accepted the appointment from this court. The order below correctly held that the plain language of Section 1083 and this court's decision in Simon foreclosed the relief that appellants seek here. As counsel just told you, appellants want this court to find that they are entitled to maintain their case under Section 1605A, but this court clearly held in Simon that the plaintiff in a case pending under 1605A7 may not maintain that action based upon the jurisdiction conferred by 1605A. Rather, as this court explained, to claim the benefits of 1605A, a plaintiff in a pending 1605A7 action had to either file a new action or file a motion to convert their action to be treated as if it were originally filed under 1605A. Appellants did not do that, and the court therefore correctly held that they were not entitled to relief under Rule 59 and 60. What counsel is arguing is essentially that the court should construe their Rule 60 motion as a motion to award punitive damages under 1605A. And this court plainly held in Simon that only plaintiffs who are proceeding under 1605A are entitled to claim the benefits of that section. To this day, appellants still claim that they are want to maintain their 1605A7 action and judgment, yet still somehow be awarded punitive damages under 1605A. And that's not what the statute contemplates.
You would acknowledge this rule is pretty harsh, the 60-day rule, because some people aren't going to have been aware of it. It's going to create, as it might have occurred here, a serious trap for people who weren't notified about the 60-day rule.
Well, I think it's important to look at what Congress is doing here. In Section C2, they're providing a rather extraordinary remedy, which is that people who are already proceeding under Section 1605A can file a motion within 60 days and have their motion converted and treated as if it had been filed from day one under 1605A. And as this court held in Gates, no new service of process is required upon the foreign state. So it's a rather extraordinary remedy that Congress is providing.
Then in creating the remedy it, with the 60-day rule, the randomness of who might be aware of that and who might not be creates all sorts of problems, right?
That's true, Your Honor. Two responses to that. First, this court has certainly held that the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act represents a very delicate legislative compromise, and so it's important to recall that if Congress is providing this extraordinary remedy, they may well want to limit
it in
some way
of supporting, as a condition of supporting the remedy, let's make sure some people aren't aware of it and lose out.
Well, Congress did provide a separate remedy in C3, and that was to file a related action. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that appellate.
That also has the same kind of issues, right?
The related actions provision does not have the strict 60-day within the from the date of enactment of the statute. Instead, it's 60 days from the date of enactment of judgment.
Right. Which in this case, they still had time to do even after they filed their 60B motion.
That's correct, Your Honor, and they did not.
When was Simon decided?
Simon was decided on June 24th, 2008. So it was before the July 17th, 2008 opinion and judgment issued. And it was, of course, then also before the appellants issued their Rule 59 and 60 motions.
And before the September deadline for filing the C3.
Exactly. So at the time that they filed their Rule 59 and 60 motion, the law was clear that 1605A was not automatically retroactive and that the appellants needed to do something affirmative. By that point, they had missed the C2 60-day window, but they had not yet missed the C3 window for filing a related
Could matter. They have argued in their 60B motion that this was a problem of mistake, neglect, surprise, that they didn't understand what the statute meant, now they understood it, and they wanted the judge to grant the 60B under that theory, and therefore extend the finality of the judgment?
I think that that would have been a difficult argument for them to have made, given that they given the time frame here. So the statute passed on in January of 2008. They filed their supplemental proposed findings claiming punitives in June of 2008. The judgment, this court then decided the Simon case, the judgment then issued in this case, and then the appellants filed their 59 and 60 motions. So Judge Lamberth, when he was sort of opening the door to whether or not the interests of justice might sometimes require the court to do that, he said, in particular, he would look at how close in time plaintiffs were to, and whether there was any guidance. And by the point that these appellants were proceeding, there was in fact guidance. So this court's Simon decision had issued, for example. So while it's perhaps hypothetically possible that a 60B motion might be available in terms of arguing the interests of justice, that's not what the appellants argued here. The only interest of justice that they argued in their Rule 60B motion was that a statute had passed in January and they had failed to take advantage of the 60-day time frame to convert their action.
Your position is that it's not hypothetically possible either.
Right. I'm saying Judge Lamberth.
You threw that out there, but your legal position here is there's no exception.
Judge Lamberth raised the issue that it may be hypothetically possible. I think that that's an issue that this court need not reach because, in any event, the motion here was not one that even Judge Lamberth contemplated in terms of what would justify the interests of justice exception under Rule 60B.
On the question of whether it's not possible, if the court were to grant a 60B1 motion, that would open the judgment again, and that would then permit an additional 60 days under 1083 for the filing of the C3, right? So that's not necessarily inconsistent with the statute at all.
Well, right, not necessarily. If the court granted a 60B motion, and gave them leave to refile under C3, I think that could conceivably be possible. But I think if the court looks at the Gonzales v. Crosby case, which appellants actually cited in their opening brief, it provides a helpful analogy. It's talking about the use of 60B motions in the context of AEDPA, and where appellants are essentially, or where a petitioner is essentially seeking to use a 60B motion as a substitute, a successive habeas petition, the court said you can't do that. And that's basically what appellants here are seeking to do. They're trying to use their 60B motion in order to just simply be awarded punitive damages in their 1605A7 action. They're not really using it in the way that a 60B motion was meant to be used. So for that reason, I think, as I said earlier, the court need not reach the hypothetical question of whether a 60B motion may ever be possible in these cases, because in this case, plainly, as Judge Garland pointed out, there was no intervening change of law, and appellants didn't even argue the interests of justice. They to this day have made no argument to any court, either the court below or this court, explaining why they missed the 60-day deadline.
What was the reasoning of Gonzales in saying that 60B could not be used as an end run around AEDPA?
that AEDPA had provided specific and detailed procedures for what a petitioner needed to do in order to bring a second and successive habeas petition, and that to use 60B essentially as a successive habeas petition would nullify all of the detailed requirements in AEDPA. And that's exactly what would happen here, that to use a 60B motion to basically say that the procedures of 1083 don't apply would render 1083 a nullity. And Congress clearly couldn't have intended to set forth this detailed scheme for plaintiffs to take advantage of new remedies if it simply contemplated that everyone could make an end run around it by using a Rule 59 or 60 motion.
That reasoning would seem to include the hypothetical that we've been talking about, a claim that the interests of justice under 60B require disregarding the 60-day limit.
I think that's right, Your Honor. I think that's correct, that the extraordinary circumstances
don't exist.
One other argument that appellants raised that I just wanted to address quickly
Can you pause for 1 second? What if they had filed? I know you don't like to deal with the hypothetical, but what if they did refiled under C3? Would the whole case have to be retried?
If they had refiled under C3, first of all, in this recent Roeder decision, the court cast some doubt upon whether C3 contemplates a plaintiff simply refiling the exact same action. What has happened in the courts below is that when plaintiffs have refiled the exact same action as a C3 action in order to claim punitive damages, and the courts have simply taken judicial notice of the prior judgment and then proceeded from there.
Roeder didn't say you couldn't do that. Roeder just said that for purposes of overcoming the Algiers Accords,
that's exactly right. There was no holding in Roeder. It was simply looking at 1083, C3, and finding it ambiguous as to whether that was even contemplated.
What happens to the $12 million if they refile the new action?
If they refile a new action, I don't believe anything happens to the $12 million. I believe that appellants are still actually, in fact, attempting to collect on that judgment, and I don't believe that judgment would be impaired in any way. They certainly would not be able to double collect on punitive damages, on compensatory damages.
They want to make sure they can singly collect.
Exactly.
And you're certain that refiling a new action doesn't have any negative impact on the $12 million they've already been awarded?
I'm not certain of that, Your Honor, but I believe that to be true based upon the district courts and how they have treated the cases that have come before them to date, that in those cases the district courts have simply looked at the prior judgment, taken judicial notice of it, and then proceeded to adjudicate punitive damages.
Mm-hmm. Well, the statute itself doesn't say anything to suggest other than that you had an action before which you didn't have a federal cause of action for, and now you can file a related action with the new federal cause of action.
In 1083 C3?
Yeah.
That's so correct, Your Honor.
I don't see what there would be in that would suggest it would put the previous action at risk in any way. You're allowed to, we've held that you're allowed to maintain both, right?
Right.
That the first one stays.
Right, exactly.
So, in fact, that is what we held in Simon.
Yeah, in Simon, right? That's what the court held, that 1605A, even though it repealed 1605A7, plaintiffs could still proceed with the 1605A7 action, and nothing would imperil that case.
If you have one in the hand and you don't have a Supreme Court ruling, you might be cautious.
I suppose that's possible, Your Honor. Just one other point that appellants raised about whether the court exercised its discretion. I think the court did, in fact, exercise its discretion in looking at the appellant's motion. It stated that it had reviewed the record in this case, including plaintiff's submissions regarding their asserted entitlement to an award of punitive damages, and it stated also that none of plaintiff's arguments in support of their request for an award of punitive damages could overcome the statutory requirements of the NDAA. So if the court has no further questions, I would ask the court to affirm the judgment below.
Did your brief make the anomaly argument that I just raised?
It raised it, yes, in the context of where appellants had argued that they were not adversely affected within the meaning. It raised it in a slightly different context than what Your Honor said, that, in fact, that would create, as Your Honor said, a strange dichotomy between cases that were still before the district court versus cases that were on appeal. Thank you.
Does counsel for the appellant have remaining time? We'll give you another 2 minutes anyway. Go ahead.
I do think that, just very briefly, I do think that there's an important consideration here. What essentially would happen by amicus's argument is that the plaintiff's filing would be getting something. That is, they could file under the new statute and would be able to pursue a punitive damage claim. But they'd also be losing something, rights that they had under the previous law to at least proceed and seek to have their punitive damage claim heard through the federal rules of civil procedure. And I do think that the issue, since it's not...
That's assuming you're correct as to the... to being able to maintain both, but what do you lose? What is the problem with maintaining your judgment for compensatory damages and filing a new action for the punitive damages under the federal cause of action, which you still had time to do as of that time? How are you harmed by that?
Well, basically, it set new time limits, well, at the time that we filed our Rule 59 and Rule 60B motions, they were timely. The time we filed our Rule 59 and 60B motions, they weren't timely for a 1083 motion. So
they were timely for a C3 motion, right? It's 60 days after entry of judgment. That would have put it at September 17th.
Well, the court and the trial court didn't construe the motions that we filed to be, because I suppose because we didn't recite 1083 as a basis for the court's being able to grant the relief. We did want the substantive relief. We didn't cite that specific section when we asked for our relief under the two rules of civil procedure.
And what about opposing amicus's point that Simon was decided in June, so that there was a decision of the circuit construing the statute already, isn't that? Not only was there the statute, there was also a decision of the circuit construing the statute.
I think all the cases have to be decided based on, you know, the Simon case didn't concern an issue like ours. It concerned an issue of for those cases that needed to be refiled. And that's not our case. We didn't need to refile a case. The only case that's really on point that would be opposite to ours is the Baumol case. But in the Baumol case, the court decided based on the idea that 1083 and that time frame for 1083 motion is actually a separate statute of limitations that should be grafted on to the 1605A-B period that's already in the statute, which I think is wrong. 1605A sets forth its own period of limitations for actions that can be brought or maintained. And that's what we sought to do. We wanted to maintain an action under 1605AB, but without utilization of 1083. And I believe that we should have the right to do that and proceed in the district court and let the district court decide whether it wants to utilize its discretion to grant that relief.
All right, thank you. I want to thank counsel for both sides for a fine argument, and particularly want to thank Ms. Amundson and Mr. De Bruin. You're appointed by the court to serve as amicus, and the court is grateful for your assistance.